Matt Segundo here, and this is my shortest introduction yet.
Okay, so I am here with A.M. Holmes, author of The Mistress's Daughter and several other books, and I think I've frightened you with my introduction. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I actually wanted to ask you, and this is sort of not particularly related to the book, but the Washington Post and the profile they put up of you on Sunday seemed to really obsess with the question that you ask of journalists, which is you you? Or, I'm sorry, are right. you you? Could be is you you, too.
Is you you, exactly.
You never actually asked that of me, so I'm wondering what maybe you could describe this question, or was this just a one-off kind of thing that
it
they obsessed
really
with?
It was really a one-off. Like, I walked in and just said to the guy, are you you? Because he's looking at me, and, you know. But it was not... No great meaning intended there.
Okay. Well, this is an obvious question, but I wanted to ask you why you felt compelled to re-explore this personal territory after you had done so with The New Yorker by expanding this into book form. I'm wondering if you wanted to push yourself as a writer more, or was this about arranging your personal narrative in a kind of permanent way? Or
well, that's a good question. It was always a book, and it just happened that The New Yorker... ran part of it, and everybody keeps saying, and then she felt compelled to write more. And I was like, no, I didn't feel compelled to write more. I was already writing more, and that was what I was doing. I felt that the first half of the book, what I wanted it to be, was I wanted the first half to essentially be what I always called the first 100 pages, which is what people read a compressed version of in The New Yorker. And then I really wanted to write what I thought was the kind of the smarter half, which seems to have eluded a lot of people, where I essentially took the narrative and smashed it with a big old sledgehammer and then really sort of dealt with essentially the rubble. And I mean that in, you know, both the Barney rubble sense and the Moon Rock rubble sense, but literally where I sort of thought about what are the pieces of this and tried to in some way not just, quote, unpack my mother, but to really look at things from many different points of view. And I think the second half is, for lack of a word, very non-traditional and not conventional by, I guess, both the who knew the rules of memoir and also, I don't know, the parts of it that I think are the best parts, like the part about the chapter like L.A. Law, and that were most interesting to me as a writer, seemed to have sort of eluded a lot of people.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about the L.A. Law chapter. Yeah. Was this from an actual deposition testimony or was this entirely invented?
It was entirely invented, and it really came out of the fact that when the lawyer asked my father for the DNA test, a copy of the DNA test, and he refused, which I somehow really thought he was just going to give it to us. And then his lawyer said that he had lost the copy, which he had, which I think most people would have fired any lawyer who lost a major document of theirs. So it's interesting that he believes that it's lost. The lawyers kept saying to me, well, you really should sue your father for paternity. And I thought, I don't really want to do that. And a couple of things became clear to me. One was how interesting it is that one person's decision to exclude you from your family history excludes you from all of your family history and hundreds of years, and yet you're no more or less related to any one person than another. And how interesting is it that just somebody could remove you from all of that? So that was kind of fascinating to me. And then I was thinking about if we did sue him, what would happen? And essentially, he would be legally compelled to not only produce some sort of a test or a document, but also to really answer all of the questions that had never been asked. And I also thought, as an artist or writer, that it was most interesting to me is, by that point, the reader knows who my biological father is well enough to participate in the reading that I could just ask the questions and not even have to provide answers. And just, you know, so I mean, I shouldn't say I enjoyed writing that part, because it wasn't about being enjoyable, but I felt that it was so in a way brutal and so direct about all the things that are not getting said and all the kind of, you know, threads through things.
Actually, speaking of which, this is a question probably nobody else has asked you, but what's up with you and the Roaf sisters? They've really got, I mean, I knew the Katie Roaf thing, right?
Yeah.
But there's also her sister in the Star Tribune, Emily, took you to task. Did you do anything to, like, really upset? I mean, I have to ask you this because no one else has asked you this question.
I know. You know, not that I know of, not knowingly. I think I must have been served at their house for Thanksgiving dinner. And, you know, her mother is also a writer. Interestingly, yeah. The father is a therapist. I feel like I was, like, dished up by the entire family, and I wanted to write, like, an open letter, you know, dear Mr. and Mrs. or Dr. and Mrs. Roify, you know, I'm concerned about your daughters. Number one, they're picking on me.
Yeah.
But also, I honestly felt that I don't mind what I call a good bad review, which is a really smart, well-thought-out bad review. I felt in this case that I was reviewed by people who were both too young and didn't have the experience to even know what they were talking about, and didn't have the perspective on what this book was or its relationship to the rest of my work to really talk about it, I don't know, thoroughly or accurately or correctly. So I felt really kind of not happy about that whole thing.
Well, the other thing, too, about some of these reviews is that
both in one weekend.
I know. That was amazing. But the thing is that in Katie's case, she was comparing this memoir to your previous work. And, you know, as if there was some sort of connection between the two, but you're writing in a completely different sort of milieu here.
Milieu.
Exactly. Milieu.
I like that book. Isn't there a book called Me and Milieu?
Peppy Milieu.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like
yes,
that.
Yes, no, it's true.
Let's talk about this. I mean, okay, so you're writing a memoir for the first time, for
right.
the most part. I think there were a couple
truly
of
truly the first time.
Really?
I mean, the first real thing
like
I remembered.
Extended,
sort of. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what did you do to approach this? Did you have different memoirs that you kind of took from the?
Oh, God, no. I don't believe in memoirs. I really don't. But I think, I mean, and this book was already well underway, but I think books like Year of Magical Thinking were kind of amazing in the sense that it also was about grief. And I think in many ways, the Mistress's Daughter has a real thread or, it's certainly a similarity. And I am a huge Didion fan anyway, and I was just very impressed that she was able to honestly survive what happened to her and just such loss and such profound loss. But in terms of memoir, I really think that the contemporary memoir, which is I describe as like the problem book, in which they're often written or mostly written by people who haven't written other books. And it's essentially their sort of therapeutic confession of their fatal flaw or their characterological, flaw or disability. And I think that people kind of consume them as a sort of a pop culture sort of therapy and 12-step thing. And I really don't go for them, which is a problem because now I've written one that you could almost call one of those. And yet I feel like the good news for me is I actually feel like, I don't in any way mean to brag, but I think my book is a better written book than most memoirs because most of them are not written at all. They're just sort of hammered out by the person telling their story. And I feel like, especially in that second half, to me, part of it really was about using my skills that I developed over the previous 8 books to really look at my life in much the same kind of horribly brutal and sort of truth-seeking way that I look at everything else. So writing a memoir for me was sort of like, I remember these vivisection posters used to be up on 8th Street where the monkey would be like cut in half and like strapped down. That was the process of writing the memoir. It was like, vivisection, A.M. Holmes.
Well, we talked last time about this notion of what you find in the headlines is obviously stranger than fiction. In this case, was truth stranger than truth? I mean, also, the other question that's kind of related to this is that you are a private person, and here
right.
you are having to, actually confess
right,
in this
exactly.
particular book.
Right.
So what was the hurdles, and was truth stranger than truth for
well,
you?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the whole reason, in part. Everyone kept saying, why don't you write this as fiction? And I kept thinking, well, I can't. It wouldn't make sense as fiction because it was actually too weird, and the people were so specific and the events so odd that it really needed to just be told as it was, and I really wanted to create a document of it as it was. The thing that's interesting from the sort of private point of view and so ironic to me is that on one hand it is a book about me, on the other hand it's really more a book about my biological parents and a book about people I never knew in a life I never had, which is so odd because on the one hand it's totally personal and kind of confessional, and yet it's who am I?
But I will so point out that you actually did, at a couple of points, really kind of resort to fiction. You mentioned the deposition chapter
yeah.
being all invented.
Yeah.
There's also the speculation you have on Ellen as to what her life could have been. I mean, were this a way of kind of deferring the inevitable question of drawing upon yourself? Or?
No, I think it's funny because the deposition chapter, I mean, as much as it's a creation, for lack of a better description, it's a real creation because were I to sue him, that would be exactly what would happen, and those would be the questions asked. So it's not created as a pure work of fiction. It's more sort of the proposition of, hey, this is what would happen. The sort of imaginings about Ellen, and I was so careful because I felt like at this time we're living in and after the James Fry thing, you have to be really careful when you're writing a memoir and know what's fact and what's not fiction. So I went out of my way every time to say, I imagine this or I imagine that when I was imagining something. I think two things. One is that in a way that wasn't something that I particularly wanted to do, and the friends who had read the book so far really encouraged me to do that and to sort of crawl inside Ellen. The other piece of that is, I think, as an adopted person, I had always spent a lot of time imagining who my parents might be. And there's actually a big section that didn't make it into the book, which are my sort of imaginings about Jack Kerouac and Susan Sontag as my parents, and or Jack Kerouac and Susan Sontag having Chinese food with Norman and Ellen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about this notion of vetting memoirs these days, thanks to James Frey.
Yeah.
You write of the New Yorker fact checker who actually asked for Norman's phone number, and the piece was actually initially killed because you actually held on to this number, and you observed that this experience practically killed you, in your words. And yet,
yeah,
you had to know, though, going into this, that they were going to... I mean, the New Yorker has a reputation for being particularly vigorous about fact-checking, so...
Well, it's a far more interesting story than that. Because when I sold the piece to the New Yorker, at that point, I had changed the names. So Norman was named Stan, and Ellen was named Helene. And I had changed them at that point, figuring I wanted to be protective of them. And it was a very big decision, which we can talk about later, about using the real names, which really came after writing the second half of the book and the genealogical work and just feeling that I couldn't keep the names changed because it was sort of changing history at that point, and also that I wasn't going to sort of participate in the shame of my existence. But that said, the New Yorker thing was that when I sold them the piece, I said, you know, I'm happy to talk to your lawyers. If you have any questions, let me know. And, you know, very all above board about it. And like, no, it's all fine. I said, okay, well, you know, I just want you to know I have all the letters. I have all, okay. Nothing happens. My editor goes on maternity leave. And the piece is sort of moving forward. And 3 days before the piece is supposed to be closed, and the magazine is closing that issue, I just, out of the blue, get an email like, hi, it's the fact-checking department. We need Stan's phone number. And I really felt like writing back, is your mother home? Because I need to talk to a grown-up. Because they somehow had forgotten that it was a piece of nonfiction. And they'd somehow just warped it into their minds that it was a piece of fiction. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, but we need Stan's phone number. And I'm thinking, okay, but there is nobody named Stan, you know. So that to me was like a real red light, that they just hadn't even read it carefully enough. And I felt that whoever the young woman was who had sent that email, I certainly was not going to give that information to. And I said to them, you know, this is an interesting problem, but this is someone whose privacy I've always protected. I'm not sure why. Complicated reasons. But I really wasn't prepared to give you that name and number. And they're like, well, you know, we have a double standard for fact-checking, which is not just that the person's identity has to be obscured to others who might know them. The person's identity has to be obscured even to the person, which is a very difficult thing to do. So if you know that you are my father, then your identity would not be obscured to you. So literally, I was standing on a street corner having like a fight with the New Yorker. And they said, you know, we need that number by 6 o'clock tonight. And it's like 5:53. And I'm literally on a street corner. I said, I don't have the number with me. I don't carry it in my pocket. I will give it to you when I get home. And we'll need to talk about what you're going to do. And they go, we're killing the story.
Yeah.
And somebody said to me, you know, they're worried that it has holes in it. And I was very offended because I thought, you know, not only is it my reputation on the line, it's actually me on the line this time. And I just thought, you know, don't mess with Mother Nature in that way. Yeah. That, remember those old like butter commercials or margarine commercials? because I was very sure of what I had written, and I knew that I hadn't fictionalized or anything. So I went in there the next day with all of the letters and all of the backup and showed them fact by fact and point by point what went where and where it had come from. And they still felt that they had 32 questions that they wanted to ask him, including things like, are you circumcised? You know, just little checkpoints. Which I'm sure most people like to just get a random call from a magazine like the New Yorker asking that. So they called him, and he actually answered the phone and then called his lawyer. And ultimately, he did not answer the questions. He refused to answer the questions, which he's entitled to. But it also is essentially like saying, you know.
You're basically disclosing, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's, you know.
It reminds me, there was a few years ago, someone had put it up on the internet. They had sent in a letter to the New Yorker to be printed. And the number of questions that they were actually responded with were like literally three times as long as the actual letter, just to clear up a little piece of information.
Oh, so sure.
It's pretty yeah, crazy over there. There's a 13 to 14 years after you learn this information in terms of dwelling upon it. I was wondering if you felt that anything was gained or gainsaid by this kind of gestation period before you decided to write about it. Or was that even an issue when you initially learned the information?
It wasn't even an issue. It wasn't really even a gestation period. I like to tell you the truth.
I hope so.
I know I do. I mean, it's funny because like the memoir, just people think it just hatches or something, or it took this long and then it hatched. I was taking notes as this was happening because that's how I process information. I couldn't imagine how odd it all was, so I would just sort of write myself little notes, and I knew I wanted to write the story down, if only to sort of document it and hold it in a certain time and place, aware of the fact of how just life changes things over time. Oh, so the gestation period.
Yes.
Back to the gestation period. It was like a baby elephant. No. It took me, you know, I was writing down stuff all the time, and I knew I wanted to create this document. And the truth is, I wrote the first 100 pages. I showed it to somebody very important in my publishing life.
Yeah.
Who responded really badly. Mm. And I wouldn't have thought this would happen, but it just stopped me right in my tracks. And I would go back and sort of every now and then try to write a little more and tell myself, come on, like, you just want to do this for yourself and you want to make this document. And it took me a very long time to get back to it. And I knew that I wanted to. And I would go back, you know, and sort of take it every time I went to Yaddo, and every time I was carrying a novel around, I was also carrying this around with me. And then finally, a few years ago, everyone knew it kind of existed, and I actually had this New Yorker contract for it, which then we, of course, promptly forgot about, and people knew there was something. No one could remember exactly what it was, but there was something. And Granta came to me and said, you know, we're doing this adoption anthology, and we really, really want something from you in it. And I kept thinking, come on, you've got these 100 pages. There has to be something in there. And I took it out, and I thought, it's fine. And it really was fine. It wasn't, there was nothing about it, for lack of a word, that I was really going to change in any substantial level. I mean, even sentence by sentence, I thought, if I were to write this again, I would write it the exact same way. So I cobbled together of the 100 pages, I sort of smushed it up. We gave Granta 40 pages, and as I was giving it to Granta, I said to my agents, don't I have a contract from the New Yorker for this? And they're like, oh, right. And they called the New Yorker and said, do you want this? And the New Yorker's like, well, yes. And then, of course, we had to gracefully take it back from Granta, which was very embarrassing, and, like, slice a little bit off the end and give it to them. Like, here, you can have the, you know, the back part of the bologna, basically. And so it went. And then, you know, months were still passing before the New Yorker was even going to run it. And that's when I really said, I really have to sort of finish what I want to do with this. And then I started going, I had to really go away to do it because I had to get very kind of deep inside myself to sort of find what I wanted.
So this is part one we're talking about.
No,
here.
This is now part two.
Oh, okay.
And I had to, I would go up to Yaddo and just sort of, you know, be doing this stuff. And I had all these bits and pieces I mean, been gathering. And then I just sort of dug in well before it was published. And then that was the publisher. I mean, that was weird in and of itself because everyone kept saying to me, you know that everybody is talking about this piece. Everybody. And I kept thinking, so weird. I'm deaf now because I don't hear a word from anybody, literally. And they're like, you must be getting hundreds of letters. And it was right around when the New Yorker and the anthrax scares were happening. So the New Yorker wasn't opening its mail. I got 3 letters. Okay. I've, no joke, farted and gotten more mail. I mean, I shouldn't say that. But seriously, it was one of those things, you know, you've written something that really, it was like making like a, it was the tree falling in the forest and not a single sound because there was nobody there. It was just deafeningly silent. And it was so odd because everyone kept saying, everybody's talking about it. And I just, they weren't talking to me. Mm. So it was just strange.
How did you work out this formula of declarative sentences and the like? Because, again, going back to the question I asked you, which you skillfully evaded, the notion of, you know, balancing the private life of the professional and what to reveal in the course of this writing.
Dude, what's a declarative sentence?
Yeah.
How do you describe a declarative sentence? Like, I this.
In the case of one of the Brophy sisters, I go to the gym is a really terrible declarative sentence.
Yeah.
I mean, just a sort of something uttered in this kind of, this declaration, essentially. I mean, you know what a declarative sentence is.
I'm working it out, though. You can't pull this thing. So what's the question?
The question is, you're good.
No, I'm not. You know, the problem is, I'm just so You know, I'm so dyslexic that I really don't actually know. I don't know really? Any. Yeah, I don't. I wouldn't know.
Okay.
I couldn't.
Well, then in that case, the actual tone.
I shouldn't
that you,
even say that, but it's just, actually true.
Let's just say that the tone that you adopted.
Yeah.
In this
adopt,
book,
no pun intended.
between the private and the professional.
Yeah.
You know, what did you do to sort of, I mean, obviously this took a long time as you sort of just described, but I mean, were there certain, you know, layers that you initially revealed, or was it just a kind of ketchup in the bottle kind of approach?
Never thought of it that way. And I was singing anticipation the whole time as I'm shaking that ketchup. You know, I have to say that part, whatever it is you're talking about over there, was just completely natural. I think maybe this answers what you're getting at a little bit, which is that it honestly was so excruciating to write about that whatever tone there is or push-pull or, you know, balance or pressure between the most intimate and personal and something a little further away was really kind of just naturally occurring, and trying to figure out how to tell a story that is really very intimate. And in many ways, the hardest part is very primal, in the sense that how do you give articulation to feelings that you started having before you had any vocabulary in any language? And I think that's one of the fundamental things about adoption and perception, and one of the ways that we can't even begin to evaluate how does it affect somebody to be essentially taken from their mother and given to some other lady.
Well, I should also note that you threw yourself into all this genealogical work, you know, during the evenings. Yes. Part two just depicted. But the thing that actually struck me was the melodramatic language that's in a lot of these court documents that you pull up. And it's almost as if in part two you're sort of responding in a weird way to some of these, you know, shocking developments of the, you know, the gradual people who you discover to be your, you know, possible ancestors.
Right, right.
So I guess, I mean, was this a way for you to kind of, I guess, push things along to complete part two at Yaddo or what else?
Was what a way? To use those documents?
Using documents and photographs and
no, in a way
ephemera.
I would have, I mean, I think if I'd truly, truly, truly done what I wanted to do, and not that anyone forcefully stopped me, but I would have used more, because I just am a person who, by nature, I love a good document. And I was really, honestly, moved by a lot of the documents I found, whether it was the law cases, the lunacy cases that are in the book, or just looking, you know, through the sort of microfilm and that the black microfilm and the writing in essentially clear or white, and this incredible kind of cursive writing from like the 1920s and 30s, and seeing, you know, like you'd see somebody who died at 13 who'd come at 11 from Germany, and what they died of, or, you know, pneumonia, or just some horrible thing that, you know, they didn't have to die of. It just was profound, really. And it wasn't about my family or my genealogy. It was about, for lack of a word, human history. And I guess that was one of the things that I think I'd always been kind of, in a funny way, history aversive, which I think, I mean, this is a whole different thing. I think is probably a classic American phenomena, is that modern Americans are not attending to their histories of any sort. And I think I'd always sort of avoided understanding really like American history and European history. And the fact is, that is our history is the most rich part of our existence, and our buildings and our architecture and our art and all of that. And it informs you enormously about who and where you are now. But as I began to kind of, for lack of a word, be less afraid of history, I'd always been kind of terrified of history. I don't know why. And you know, if I was truly smart, I would find a way to write something about like fear of history, because that would be an interesting essay.
I think it's more of the sort of noble, serious pronouncements, the idea that history is this kind of stern thing you attend to, when it's really a lot of fun.
Oh, it's amazingly interesting. I mean, it's very much alive. But it, all that kind of really kind of came to life for me, and that, for lack of a better word, was the part that really made me feel good. So if I could have done something more, I would have added, you know, all kinds of fragments of things. I also really love ephemera, honestly.
I wanted to actually ask you, and this is a little bit of a tougher question, but some of the writing in this judges a lot of the people. I wanted to actually quote the woman on the other end of the phone at the DNA clinic. Yeah. I'll read this particular part. You write, "I'm on hold for a long time, and it occurs to me that she just put me on hold to make me wait and is sitting there on the other end picking her nose." And then you also write, There's a particular coldness, a kind of self-satisfaction to the way these people say, we don't have that, as though they have no idea what that might mean. They really don't care, as though they get enormous and perverse pleasure from emptying the electronic trash can on their computer screen. Gone, gone, and gone. Now, is that, though, entirely fair to the person on the other end? I mean, why cast judgment like that? That's pretty harsh, if
well,
you ask
me. It's so interesting, because I think of myself as somebody who's not very judgmental, and I tend not to be that harsh. It's interesting. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, it's
and
genuinely
your other work
interesting.
Too
yeah, no, it's genuinely yeah. interesting yeah. that you're sort of noticing that. I think, and I don't really know the answer to that question. I think, you know, when you point out that passage, there is something to it that I wouldn't necessarily describe as judgmental, but I think there's a lot of, for lack of a better word, complex feeling, like everything from, you know, Jennifer at Cellmark or wherever it was, really did respond like a mechanized whatever. And I think there's obviously no way for Jennifer to know what did it take for me to call her and how far did I have to come to even get up the courage to think maybe Cellmark still has this. But I think it's also when you start listening to stories about people who are adopted and people who have, for lack of a better word, no access to their history. And that's really part of what this is, you know, that when you're adopted, you can't find out who you are and you can't find out where you come from. And it is maddening because there are people like Jennifer, for example, yeah. who have access to something, or if they really wanted to find something, they could find it. Or, you know, people who go to the records rooms to get their records and are told that they can't see them. But that person who's telling you that can just go look up your parents right there if they want to. Yeah. So I think that there is a kind of both anger and fear and frustration that may read as judgmental right there. But it is interesting just in light of how I normally think of myself.
That's
I've given this girl here a hard time, but I feel she did deserve it.
Well,
she wasn't friendly.
Well, she was okay.
She was okay, but not...
Believe me,
She wasn't going out of her way to be nice.
She turned down the music for us. I'm just saying, you know, yeah. it's interesting.
You're so nice. Are you a Buddhist?
No, I'm not.
Really? Do you have a spiritual anything?
I'm a humanistic atheist, so there you go.
Yeah.
You know, Vonnegut's death meant a lot to me. Let's talk about this. I mean, because that's exactly why it surprised me, this particular passage, because all of your other books are really about challenging these particular folkways. Sven Burkitt's review in the LA Times book review was, to me, the most interesting because he had praised your clipback style for this, mm-hmm. but he also noticed this exact same distance that kind of prevented the reader from really getting involved with this. I'm wondering if this goes back to what I suggested earlier, which is like you were writing and fictionalizing Ellen in a way to kind of not necessarily write about yourself, maybe. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. It's funny. That was the one thing about that review that sounds so funny to say that really pissed me off. Because I think I feel like in a no-win situation with that, because I think when people look at the Didion book and they look at her style of writing, I don't know that they criticized her for that. And that book is double, you know, if people think she's cold, that book is double cold. Yeah. It's very whatever. I think it's the difficulty of, for lack of a better word, trying to find language for emotion and not trying to exceed the capacity of the reader or to write something that's so, I don't know exactly how to say it, it's so just all about I feel this, I feel that. And I feel like, honestly, the English language does not have the right words for variation in emotion. We only have kind of, you know, happy, sad, frowning. You know, they talk about like in Vietnamese and other languages, there's like 10 words for a certain thing or different intonations of things to have different edges of meaning. And I by no means was about to start making a new vocabulary of words that people had never heard of before. But I think that's part of the problem. It sort of bums me out to think that there's something about the style that would stop the reader from participating, because I really want the reader in that book.
But I mean,
I have to rewrite the whole thing.
Well, going back to this woman on the phone, I mean, you could have easily said, I feel, you know, really anxious. She's probably doing her job. But instead, you're like, instead of actually confessing that, you're externalizing onto her. That's what
I'm
saying here, you know.
I'm going to have to talk to my therapist about that.
Okay. Well, I mean, you
maybe
know,
you'd like to come to the next session and we can kind of all go we'll over go ahead, it. We'll invite Sven.
We'll bring the annotated
absolutely
version of the book. But
say,
no,
I'm
but
concerned
I mean,
about my future but going, as a therapist.
Going back, and I know, yeah, you know, authorial intention is an annoying subject to
no,
answer in this particular thing, but I mean, why?
Now I am feeling nervous.
Why blame the woman on the phone? Why not just say, I am really anxious about this? Because, I mean, we're reading the book and we know. We know that this is a huge deal. I
right.
mean,
it's interesting. I don't know the answer. I'm going to have to really think about that for a while.
Okay. Well,
but it is interesting.
Okay.
I mean, you're on to something. I don't know exactly what, but you're on to something. Now I feel like I'll never write good fiction again in some
no,
way. Like
no.
It'll all be like accidentally, you know.
No. I know you're good for more.
No, but it's also interesting because I feel like even in this book, I thought, until we've had this conversation.
Yeah.
That even for the most part, in writing about Norman and Ellen, that I sort of, for lack of a better word, let them tell their own histories or write their own histories with what their language and their behavior was, and that I'm not all that judgmental about who they are or what they did. But I think what you're talking about is interesting, and I don't really have the right, I don't have an answer for it. I mean, I have to sort of think about it.
Okay, well, then let me take a different tack. It's the coughing interview.
I know.
it's
particle season here in San Francisco.
Anyway.
It's part of global warming and the particles isn't because
global
big pieces of the atmosphere are just flaking off now. We're choking on them.
Global warming or global warming?
Warming. That too.
Yeah. Well, okay, so, okay. Were there any restrictions you set upon yourself when you wrote this? Any sort
None.
Of blocks or stumbling things?
No.
Okay.
No.
Nothing?
No.
Okay.
No sense that there was somewhere I was going to not go. I was willing, you know, ever since the end of Alice, where my pact with myself was, I will not run from wherever this book takes me.
Okay.
I have stayed that way, and I think that it's good news and bad news. It's very there's a lot of wear and tear on the author, but no, I went, you know, wherever I felt I could go or had to go, and I didn't feel like there was anything I ran away from. I feel like there was a moment when I was interviewing various of these relatives, and I made this appointment to see this guy, Warren Hecht in New York, who then canceled the last minute. And he really is a fairly close relative. And I had copies of like his grandmother's birth certificate for him and things I'm sure he doesn't even have. And I felt very hurt when he canceled that interview. And I thought, why am I like calling all of these people? Because it's not like I'm getting really quality information from them. And I did at that point just think, I have to take a break from this part of it for a while. But that was really the only piece I sort of walked away from thinking this just hurts too much.
I'm wondering if, was motherhood a factor in terms of re-exploring these emotions, or?
No, you know, everyone keeps talking about that, and I would say everything from, I didn't know my daughter well enough to write yeah. much about her, and I still don't. And, you know, when she's like 30, maybe I'll have something to say about her. And honestly, the process of becoming a mother and the whole having a baby, I mean, it's very different than, you know, they're small and they don't talk and they're it's not like having a person you can interview. I mean, it's just, you know, so tell me, you know, little baby, where are you from? No,
you clearly haven't figured out the semiotics of like goo-gooing and gaga-ing there.
No, I really haven't. And I you know, I'm one of those people who I do better when they get bigger. And in fact, I asked my daughter once, when she was still fairly small, I said, do you want to know where you came from? And she said, yes. Because I thought, I was just curious when we were ever going to begin talking about these things. And I said, well, where do you think you came from? And she said, Guatemala, which is not true. She came from my body.
At least she's got the sense of humor.
I know,
that's
exactly.
Good. Actually, here's something that no one else has commented upon, and I wanted to actually ask you about. The whole Daughters of the American Revolution tie-in. This was very interesting to me because it is such an absurd kind of way of trying to connect here. And yet at the same time, it's also something that goes against your own ideology.
Absolutely.
So maybe you can talk about the kind of conflict of...
Well, sure. And I think the first thing about that is when a person is learning their history and trying to learn their history, you don't always like what you find. And I think the DAR thing, you know, philosophically and politically in every which way, I am completely not in alignment with the DAR. But it is a lineage organization, and I really wanted to see what that process of stepping into a line would be like, whether or not you are in agreement with the line. I also think, honestly, going back to sort of notions of history, that, you know, you have to know your history, and it doesn't mean you have to like your history, but you have to know your history. One of the books I did read while I was writing this was Strom Thurmond's daughter's book, and in it she also talks about deciding to pursue joining the DAR. Anyway, it was interesting to me, you know, to sort of think about that. And I think the other piece of it, which I had just never really been that aware of, is what it is when one person excludes you from your history. When my father, by deciding that he did not want to share the results of the DNA test, basically effectively separates me from all of the rest of the family lines. And it's not so literal, but it is a kind of conceptual thing, and it really bothered me, and I think I hadn't expected that in some way. And I think, honestly, there are a lot of people who are adopted and who are kind of fractured away from their families who things like that are, they're really bothered by things like that. I mean, there are people who spend their whole life trying to fix something or repair it. So it wasn't the DAR per se, but I also think it is interesting. It is interesting to think about what does it mean when Strom Thurmond's daughter, who is black, joins the DAR. What does it mean when the subversive, you know, difficult novelist joins the DAR? It means that the DAR itself is not the same as it once was. And that interests me, you know, how an organization goes from being one thing to another. And just, I mean, again, sort of the flow of history, you know.
Well, they also, the kind of malleable nature of history, how things shift, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And the DAR will tell you that we are, basically, it's so funny, like, yeah. This is a joke, but we are not your mother's DAR, you know, that they are now different,
the new DAR.
And I'm not really sure that that's true, by the way, but it is interesting, you know.
There's a new PR campaign.
Absolutely.
Well, okay, yeah. I want to actually ask you about something that Maude Newton observed about this book, and that is that there is no triumphant conclusion. And you basically end on a kind of, you know, the celebration of mystery of family, as Maude put it. Now, I wanted to actually ask you, do you think there are too many contemporary memoirs that have a sort of tidy existential conclusion? Or was this something, were you determined to just really just end it and show, hey, there are no clear-cut answers for life? Or maybe you can talk about
this. Yes and yes and yes. Now, I think, yes, too many things are tied up nicely at the end. And I think, unfortunately, it's misleading to perhaps a less sophisticated part of the population who actually believes that life should be like that. And then we expect that from ourselves and from our lives. I think that there are no clear-cut anythings, and that's sort of like the Buddhist-y piece of me. I also think that adoption in particular, both for a birth mother who gives up a child, for a family that adopts a child, or for an adoptee, is an ongoing, lifelong thing. It's not a one-time event. It's part of your life, whether, you know, a child who's adopted goes off to school for the first time, often has more separation anxiety. A birth mother who's given a child away, who ultimately is marrying somebody, has enormous anxiety and probably isn't having told that man that she's given a child away. A family that adopts a child has reasons why they adopt a child, and those often never get resolved. So there's so much stuff that flares up again and again over the course of someone's life, and I think adoption is really life under an electron microscope. There's nothing about adoption that is particularly entirely unique to adoption. It is about identity and about family narrative, and it just goes on. There is no end. And I think that's actually okay and like a good thing about it.
Yeah, gotcha.
I don't really want life to end.
Who does? I mean, aside from a depressive. Sorry, I don't. It's this damn.
Kurt Vonnegut was getting kind of testy.
No. We should point out that this is being recorded, you know, after Vonnegut has died, and then on the wake of this Virginia Tech mass murder, yes, which is the largest mass shooting in American history, apparently. Which,
well, you know, the horrible thing about that too is, I remember when Music for Torching came out.
Yeah.
Music for Torching came out 3 weeks before Columbine.
That's right.
And everybody said to me when Columbine happened, "Did you do that?" Meaning, because Music for Torching has this ending, and it was so interesting to me at the time that people, and still are, shocked by the ending of that book. And I think that things like that happen because we're really, and this is sort of what Music for Torture was about, we're really not reading the signals well enough.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way and no reason why things like that should happen. It's like, it's a social responsibility of a school and of parents and of people around people. There are things that tell you that, like, trouble is coming.
I wanted to go back into the Ellen fictionalization and how you sort of really dwelt upon this period in the 1950s as she's having this affair. I was wondering why did you start at the particular point when she was like this teenager? I mean, why didn't you go and try to fictionalize earlier? Or did you try to fictionalize earlier and you just kind of dwelt upon
It's funny. I feel like, boy, I'm flunking interview today.
No.
I don't know why. It seemed to me I was thinking about when she sort of left home and where she went and how she went. And my sense was that she left home to get away from something, but also not really an adult and not really capable of taking care of herself, and essentially, you know, left and kind of played house in some way. And it was very depressing. Why did I not start earlier? You know, it's funny, if I think about her life earlier, I think about a person's kind of psychic development. And I think about, you know, her early childhood, where she probably thought things were pretty good, although she always had a difficult relationship with her mother, but I think she really enjoyed her father. I don't know if she had any sense of him as kind of a, quote, bad person, or, you know, somebody who was essentially a criminal, or really what her experience or reaction was when he was killed, because she was not a very good reporter of herself. And then I picture her life after that, and I picture her mother as this very difficult woman, but also somebody who I think didn't want to be alone, wanted to be taken care of, so she remarried this man who had a child already. And I think, you know, he wasn't a good guy for my mother. It's just interesting. I think if I really try to go inside it and think about it as fiction, it's also so painful in terms of her and thinking about a child's development and a child's dependency on adults and how adults can really harm somebody. It's just awful.
And then there's the manner in which she constantly contacted you, which is, you know, later in life, although earlier in the book, too.
Yeah.
I guess, you know,
For me, the question always becomes is, how does a person become that pathetic, really needy, often kind of almost animalistic person? And you go back in their life and you see just one horrible thing after another. It's very, very depressing.
But we're also talking, going back to this issue of judgment, we're counting exclusively on your side of the story. It's very possible that this is a sudden vault for all parties. I mean, I guess what we would consider normal civilized behavior when you're talking about long-lost mother, long-lost daughter, is it really fair to kind of cast that? I mean, it may have been extraordinary behavior. I'd be calling you in the middle of the blue like that, certainly. But can you actually, I guess, judge because of the circumstances?
Judge in what way?
Judge her as this completely pathetic sort of person. She can't be entirely that way.
I think when I think of pathetic, I think of somebody who's like an injured dog. You know what I mean? I think of somebody who's, I don't mean pathetic as a judgment, I mean it like as an adjective. Okay. But I think her life was really awful. And in a way, I feel badly that by the time she got to me, I mean, she really was a mess and really wasn't living in reality as most of us sort of know reality. And I feel very badly about all of it. I also think, you know, and I write a little bit about this, but it was unfortunate. I mean, she really was frightening to me, and really I felt both wanted to consume me, but also, interestingly, it wasn't even me as I knew myself. She wanted to consume her fantasy of me, which was, it was so like a fracture from reality to have somebody sit across from you and not see you, but see some fantasy of you and be disappointed by what they were seeing in some way. I could tell that she was disappointed. I wasn't what she wanted me to be, which was very weird because I kept thinking, okay, I'm more than like most people turn into, and I feel pretty good about myself, but somehow I'm not good enough for you. I mean, this is so, again, it's like just pathological, interesting. And she wasn't articulate enough to say to me anything about what she was imagining or hoping or desiring. And I think she really did somehow want to be taken care of. I think her fantasy was that she would find me and find my father and that we would all be some sort of a family.
But in your own way, in actually fictionalizing her, aren't you fantasizing her a bit too?
Well, I'm sure I am. I'm fantasizing her in line with what I know of her. If I was really fantasizing her, I would fantasize something completely different. You know, I would fantasize like Audrey Hepburn. I think that.
That's
I
one
think
hell of
Audrey.
A fantasy
right.
There,
I think she would have been a much more appropriate mother for me.
Yeah. All of us, I suppose. Well, I won't press you further. It was a pleasure to chat with you as always. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.